Chapter 15. The Minefield. Books moving from non-fiction to fiction was uncommon, but it did happen. The most recent immigrant was I Got Beaten Every Day for 8 Years by My Drunken Father, from Misery Memoirs, when it was discovered the author had made most of it up. By all accounts, 8 years had to leave in disgrace, tail between bruised legs, but I think secretly delighted. There is nowhere more depressing than Misery Memoirs, and the few visitors it has are usually characters in training who have a tricky scene to do in human drama and need some inspiration. Bradshaw's Bookworld Companion, 10th edition. Sprocket and the cabbie looked outside. Surrounding the car were 500 or so mimes, all dressed uniformly in tight black slacks, a stripy top, white grease paint, and a large hat with a flower stuck in the crown. They were miming in the most terrifying fashion, their hideous faces contorted with exaggerated expressions, their bodies moving in a frighteningly sinuous movement that defied written description. The cabbie panicked and started the engine. It burst into life, and he popped the car into reverse. "Hold it," I said, looking out the rear window. "You can't go backwards. There's a mime stuck inside a pretend glass cube just behind you. Wait, he's out. No, hang on. There's another bigger pretend glass cube outside the smaller one." The cabbie started to sob. "Calm down," I said. "Panic is the mind-killer. We can get out of this alive if we keep our heads straight. Turn the engine off." We glanced around as the mimes, now curious, moved closer. I almost cried out as one peered into the car while doing a routine with a balloon that was heavy, then light, then immovable. "What are they doing?" asked the cabbie, his voice tremulous with rising fear. "I don't understand." Comedy was one of those genres that, while appearing quite jolly, was actually highly dangerous. In order to generate new jokes, the custodians of the genre had tried to use non-written and non-verbal comedy as a growing medium. Mimes had no real home in a written or spoken canon, but some of their movements and actions could cross-pollinate with others that did. Slapstick was used for the same effect, as was a well-timed look, a comical pause, and silly expressions, voices, and walks. "Don't move," said Sprocket. "Mimes don't generally attack unless they are threatened." "How do you threaten a mime?" "By sighing during a performance, looking away, rolling your eyes, that sort of thing. Mimes hate being ignored or having their performance interrupted. In that respect, they're almost as touchy as poets." We did as I suggested, and watched as the mimes continued their strange movements, and we laughed and applauded at the right moments. Some of the mimes appeared hardly to move at all, and adopted poses like statues, and others seemed to be walking against the wind. There was also a lot of going in and out of doors that weren't there, canoeing, and pretending to walk up and down stairs. It was all very mystifying. Mind you, I was worried just how long we could laugh and applaud. Every moment we paused, they became dangerously aggressive once more. After another 5 minutes of this odd posturing, the cabbie couldn't take it any more. He flung open his door and made a run for it. We watched with growing horror as the unfortunate taxi driver was suddenly copied in his every movement and expression. Two mimes walked close behind him, while another engaged in some curiously expressive banter. Within half a minute, it was all over, and the cabbie's tattered clothes were all that remained upon the ground. I looked at Sprocket, whose eyebrow flicked up to doubtful, which meant he was out of ideas. Now that they had been blooded, the mood of the mimes seemed to have changed. A minute ago their features had been ridiculously smiley, but now they wore doleful expressions of exaggerated sadness. They also seemed to be approaching the car. Once they got in, it would be all over. Or at least it would be for me. "Lean forward." "Might I inquire as to why, ma'am?" I'm going to press your emergency spring release, I said. You'll be nothing but an inert box of cogs to them, and they'll not touch you. Someone will chance across you in a few months, and you can be rewound. You can tell them what happened. He looked at me and buzzed for a moment. Would that be a compassionate act on your behalf, ma'am? I suppose so. Only one of us need die. Sprocket thought about this for a moment. I'm sorry, ma'am, but I may have to politely decline your offer. A butler never leaves his position and is loyal until death. I made a grab for the access panel in the back of his left shoulder, but he caught my hand with surprising speed. In this matter, ma'am, he said firmly, my cogs are made up. I relented, and Sprocket let go of my arm as several mimes improvised a trampoline routine on the back bumper. Okay, I said, as a sudden thought struck me. Here's the plan. I need you to act like a robot. How do I do that? You tell me. You're the robot after all. Agreed, but the whole point of the duplex series is that we act human in order to function more seamlessly with our masters. More human than the dumbest human is the Duplex Corporation's motto. I don't know the first thing about actually being a robot. You're going to have to give it your best shot. Sprocket raised his eyebrow as a shower of broken glass erupted from the rear window. The mimes had become markedly more aggressive when we weren't laughing and applauding hard enough during a not very amusing routine where they pretended to sculpt a statue out of clay. Very well, said Sprocket. He opened the car door and stepped out. His gait was sporadic and clumsy, and at the end of each movement there seemed to be a slight spring to his actions that gave the impression of increased mass. The effect upon the mimes was instantaneous and dramatic. They all took a step back and gazed in wide-eyed astonishment as Sprocket lumbered from the car with me close behind. A few of them dropped to their knees, and others fell into paroxysms of exaggerated crying. "What do I do?" whispered Sprocket. "I can't keep this up for long." "Head back towards the road." So he did, and I followed him. The mimes stayed with us, their grief and sadness changing to anger and surprise. Sprocket continued his overblown movements, but it wasn't working. The mimes closed in, and just when their white gloves were upon us, they suddenly paused and exhibited the sort of mock surprise you can feign by opening your mouth wide and placing both hands on your cheeks. The reason for this was soon apparent. One of their number had started to copy Sprocket in a series of similar robotic moves. Uncertain at first, the moves soon gained fluidity until his gestures exactly matched Sprocket's. Within a few seconds, the robot idea had spread among them like a virus, and the field was full of 500 or so mimes acting like robots. As soon as they were all distracted in this fashion, I yelled, "Run!" and we sprinted back to the road. "Well," said Sprocket, stretching the barbed quip wire back across the hole in the fence to keep the 500 or so mimes from escaping. "I think that was a close-run thing, ma'am. Might I congratulate you on your quick thinking?" "Let's just say it was a team effort." He bowed politely, and I sat on a rock by the side of the road to regain my composure. I looked around. The dusty track was empty in both directions, and aside from the books drifting silently overhead and the now robotic mimes, the only signs of life were corralled jokes of questionable taste sitting silently in fenced-off areas a little way distant. "Did you get a good look at that car that passed us?" I asked. "Yes, ma'am. I believe it was a 1949 Buick Roadmaster." "Men in plaid?" "So it would appear. Their capacity for causing us harm and annoyance seems not to be abating." I saw it simpler. They had just tried to kill us. The only question that remained was, why? And more worryingly, how much longer before they succeeded? Just then, a rattly pickup stopped opposite us. The bearded driver was staring at us with an amused twinkle in his eye. He was a funster, one of a hardy breed of crusty old men and women who spent their days trapping gags and taking them to market.
"Have an accident?" he asked.
It was the height of bad manners in comedy to decline a feed line when offered, so I had to think quickly.
"No thanks," I replied. "I've already had one."
The funster laughed, took off his hat, and mopped the sweat from his brow. He looked a while at the mimes, who had evolved their new robot idea into robots going downstairs, robots canoeing, robots getting stuck inside glass cubes, and robots walking against the wind.
"Looks like you might have started something," said the funster with a chuckle, climbing out of the cab and rummaging for a net and a baseball bat in the flatbed. "Wait here."
A few moments later, we were bowling down the road towards the railway station, sitting in the back of the flatbed. On one side of us, there was a mime who was miming a robot being trapped inside a net, while actually being trapped inside a net, and on the other side of us was a mature Austrian gentleman with a beard, a small hat, and the look of someone who was trying to figure out what we were thinking and why we were thinking it. After considering us for a moment, he leaned forward and said,
"How many Sigmund Freuds does it take to change a light bulb?"
"I don't know," I said. "How many?"
"Penis," said the Freud,
then quickly corrected himself.
"I mean, father. No, wait. One. One Sigmund Freud. All it takes? Yes. Verflucht und zugenäht,"
he added gloomily.
"Wenn ich nur bei der Allsektion geblieben wäre."